This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And on this Intelligent Medicine Podcast, we talked about all manner of diets. We've evaluated vegetarian diets, Mediterranean diets, omnivore diets, ketogenic diets, and anti-inflammatory diets. But what may be as important as the constituents of the diets is the quantity and timing of the diet. And that's a subject that our guest is very, very well acquainted with. He's devoted his life to research on the subject of longevity. He's written a great book called The Longevity Diet. He's Dr. Walter Longo. And Dr. Longo is the director of the Longevity Institute of the University of Southern California in LA and of the program on longevity and cancer at the IFOM Institute in Milan. He is from a town in Italy that happens to be the home of some of the longest living people in the world. So he has a background that is both scientific and personal with regard to longevity. So welcome to Intelligent Medicine. It's really a pleasure having you on the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. First of all, give us a little bit of background on how you got into the study of longevity.
Basically, I'm not sure why, but that's all I've ever done since I was in my second year in college. I just thought that this was such an incredible scientific challenge, but also something that was so relevant to many, many different diseases and to medicine. And so from that time where I switched to music, actually, to biochemistry, that's all I've ever done is to study aging, and I've always been fascinated with the process of or how to make people live to 100 or 110 healthy.
Indeed. And in fact, you spent some of your early career studying with Roy Walford, who is actually well known as the somewhat ill-fated researcher who undertook the biosphere experiment with caloric restriction. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. And in fact, I was in his lab when he was inside of the biosphere, and I was there when they came out of this biosphere too. Enterprise, if you want to call it that, which I think had both incredible data and you know, incredibly positive data, but also negative data. And that was, to me, it was the very early, it was 1992 when they came out. It was very early, the beginning of my PhD at UCLA in his lab. And, but that was a great learning experience because it on one side, it showed me how a lot of the risk factors that we see in medicine are the consequence of the diet. Because, for example, if you look at their blood pressure, cholesterol, the fasting glucose, etc., they were extraordinarily affected by the calorie restriction. But then if you looked at them, you realized that they looked like a group of anorexic people. Right. And it was very easy to see that this is not the way. So there is a solution there if you can solve the problem of making people starve for that long of a period.
Exactly. If you go to a meeting of the Caloric Restriction Society, it's not very much fun, is it? And the people look a little bit gaunt. And so you have developed a paradigm which may harness some of the benefits of caloric restriction, or as it's sometimes abbreviated, CR, and it's we have some new initials. It's FMD. So how does FMD differ from straight out lifetime commitment to eating 60% of optimal or normal calories?
Yeah, so this is completely different, and the major advantage that we've had, of course, is the genetics, the molecular biology, and all the way to the clinical trial, the mouse studies, the clinical trial. So Roy, and at that time, we didn't have any of that. And so my lab, in fact, went on to describe both the what I call the protein aging pathway and the sugar aging pathway, and one is called Taurus kinase, and the other one PKA. And so having this understanding of the connection between what food contains, and particularly micromolecules and micronutrients like sugars and proteins, and having the connection between these and the genes, then it was much easier to try to get the good and not the bad of calorie restriction. So in calorie restriction, basically, you have less food, not necessarily less proteins, all the time, and so what happens, you lose water, you lose muscle mass, and you also lose fat, and now you enter somewhat of an anti-aging mode, and that's what we knew at the time. Then we found out with monkey studies, with human studies, with mouse studies, that it wasn't as positive as we thought. For example, in the mice, now we know that if you chronically restrict mice for life, but a third of them live longer, a third of them don't have any effect, and a third of the genetic backgrounds have a negative effect, right? So, and if you look at the monkey studies, you know, 25 years of work, in one study, you have great effects on diseases, no doubt about it, but not much of an effect on lifespan. And so this is telling you that both the mouse studies and the monkey studies, and I think the human studies are in agreement with that, that this can have a tremendous effect on diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, but somehow it probably has negative effects on maybe immune function, wound healing, and responses to many other challenges. And so in the end, it doesn't really help you that much. With the periodic fasting mimicking diet instead, we think we have found a way to keep the good and get rid of the bad, meaning that these are done in the clinical trial. We did it only once a month for 5 days. This is it's fasting mimicking because it has ingredients that fool the system into entering and staying in a full fasting response mode, even though you're not fasting. So we did this once a month for 5 days for 3 months. And a lot of the effects that we see are, in fact, what you see in calorie restriction. But we, of course, don't see the problems, don't have the problems with calorie restriction. So people go back to the normal diet for the 25 days in between. And we also suspect, as we've seen for mice, that they eat a little bit more during the 25 days. So they compensate for everything they don't eat during the 5 days. We know this for a fact in mice, but we also suspect it in people. And yet both mice and people lose weight, particularly abdominal fat while they're doing this. But they also have reduction of cholesterol, blood pressure, triglyceride, fasting glucose, systemic inflammation, etc., particularly if they start with the problem to begin, meaning that people that are very healthy to begin with, you don't see big effects, but people that are less healthy, then you see bigger effects.
Indeed. And this is a form of intermittent fasting, which, you know, a lot of people follow the paleo diet, but what the paleo diet means to them is that I'll eat like a caveman, you know, from 8 in the morning till midnight, all paleo-allowed foods. But what's truly paleo is that there were episodes of deprivation and starvation that were part of the natural cycle, and there were times of plenty. And so, in a sense, we're kind of moving more towards a truer mimicking of a paleo lifestyle for which we're evolutionarily adapted.
Yes, I mean, in the paleo, we have to be very careful, and that's why I think it's good to have experts dealing with this, because people don't realize that in the paleo period, people died very early. So the force of natural selection was really based on, say, a lifespan of 45, 50 years. Now we're trying to live to 110. It's a very different story, right? So that diet was never optimized for longevity. So it's a big misconception to think that just because we used to do something, that also is consistent with a 100 years old, 100 years healthy lifespan. And this is why in the book I talk about five pillars. And I say, you know, you have to do epidemiology. You have to look at epidemiological studies. You have to look at clinical studies. You have to look at basic research focused on longevity. And then another major pillar is the centenarians. What about centenarians? If you look around the world, almost no none of the population that have record longevity have a paleo diet. Right. And so that should be already a concern, right? Because, you know, it may very well be that it turns out that a very specific type of paleo diet is going to turn out to be extraordinary. But the risks you're taking are very big, right? And so much better to go with what I describe in the book to be a low protein vegan pescatarian diet. So fish and vegetables, because that's consistently associated with the data from all these pillars, rather than taking a chance on something that was never, has never evolved to optimize lifespan, healthy lifespan, but has evolved to optimize early reproduction. So no doubt if you have a paleo diet, you're probably going to reproduce very well. The question is, what's going to happen to you when you're 75, 80, 85, and nobody knows?
Interesting. You write in your book, and I think this is one of the key paragraphs in the book, the body's innate ability to regenerate itself at the cellular and organ levels. Modern diet and constant consumption keep these mechanisms switched off. That's an important concept that you have enunciated. But you also write, as I discovered over the past 30 years of research, that switch can be turned back on rather easily. So explain how that happens in, you know, with your FMD, the fasting mimicking diet.
Yes. So I think in a way, fasting was probably, and this is speculation, but fasting was probably like sleep. So something that has a purpose. It's not just there by mistake. It has a purpose. And so somehow, because we were forced to fast very frequently, it was almost impossible for anyone to go more than a few months without having a period of fasting. We probably started utilizing this fasting as a way to reset everything, right? And so, and the reason for it is very simple, is that when you're fasting, the body has to go into a an autophagy mode, but also a mode where cells are destroyed.
So for definition, autophagy, you're about to say, you know, auto means self and phagy means to eat. You're eating yourself?
Right. You're eating yourself. So what happens is, and this has been very well established for a long time, that inside of a cell, if you're starving, the cell starts eating its own components. And the reason it does that is a dual reason. One, you want to be lighter. You know, I always talk about an analogy with a wood burning train is running out of fuel. And so the engineer decides to take parts like chairs made of wood and walls made of wood, and he uses those to burn as fuel, right? So now when you get to the next station, you can now rebuild the chairs, rebuild the walls. So now you made it to the station and you have a newer train in a sense, right? So that's exactly what the body does. You want to be lighter because, of course, that consumes less energy if you're starving. But then you want to use that, those components as fuel. And then, of course, you know, let's say that you did that for a week or two. Now, a lot of the organs and intracellular components, the cells get lighter and the organs get lighter. So you're going to have less cells and less components of cells. And of course, you have to rebuild them when you refeed, right? And that's also, I think, the major problem with calorie restriction. You never have the refeeding. Uh-huh. And that turns out that the refeeding, maybe the rebuilding, is the most important part. So imagine if that train kept using the chairs and the walls, and it kept doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it, right? Eventually, you'll have a train with no chairs, no walls, and you have a problem, right? And that's probably what happens with the calorie restriction. The rebuilding is as important as the fasting, and that's where the stem cells get turned on and regenerate whatever you depleted. But now, of course, we suspect and have evidence for when you regenerate. For example, we had a paper on multiple sclerosis, mostly mice but also humans, a couple years ago, and we showed that when starvation destroys, it preferentially destroys damaged cells. And then it can turn on stem cells, but it probably knows which stem cells are still healthy, right? So it selects the good stem cells so they can rebuild, new components, in this case, the immune cells that are no longer autoimmune. So it destroys autoimmune cells, turns on hematopoietic stem cells, and then during the refeeding, and only during the refeeding, or mostly during the refeeding, now you have the rebuilding of the differentiated immune cells.
Were there objective improvements in the experimental animals or the humans undergoing this process who were suffering from MS?
Yeah, the mice, the results are extremely positive, to the point that about 20% of the mice are completely free of the MS symptoms, and about 50% have drastic improvements. But overall, there are major improvements. And in humans, so far, we just had a preliminary study with about 45 patients, and we showed they reported improvement in quality of life. But of course, and now we're going to do a multi-center study in Europe, and that's going to take a couple of years to have a real answer from a randomized clinical trial.
Indeed. So your general recommendation is that the two major culprits here are excess sugar, particularly refined carbohydrates, but also excess protein being a generator of IGF-1, as is, and to some extent, carbohydrates. But by restricting protein, it seems to fly in the face of recent findings that older adults especially need more protein than we thought. Can you reconcile those things?
Yeah, those are our findings, right? So we published that paper. So, so that's what we publish. When we look at proteins and mortality, both from cancer and all causes, it turns out that you see no effect, right? But then if you divide it in two, so you look at 65 and younger and 65 and older, the 65 and younger, if they have a low protein diet, low but sufficient, by the way, uh-huh. If you have a low but sufficient protein diet, then you do much better, to the point that you cut overall mortality in almost half for the 20 years following these people were followed up, and cancer mortality risk was reduced by 75%. So huge effects. But if you look at older people, they seem to do better if they had a moderate to high protein intake. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense. We also had mouse studies where we show that if you take young mice and you severely restrict them of protein, they do okay. If you instead take older mice or old mice and you do protein restriction, then they do very poorly and they start losing weight, right? So frailty, we're showing this also for fasting and fasting mimicking diets. When you get to old mice or old people, these extreme interventions, whether it's a severe protein restriction or fasting, is probably not such a good idea. And so now we're developing, for example, fasting mimicking diet. We're about to start a trial both here and in Europe on Alzheimer's, and we're developing an Alzheimer fasting mimicking diet that is higher in calorie and that might be more feasible for older individuals.
Is there a role for TRF, or time-restricted fasting, in this scheme of things? In other words, breakfast late, eat dinner early, and then go 14 or 16 hours without eating.
Yeah, I in general, I think it's a bad idea. So I think that time-restricted feeding is very important, but it should be between 11 and 13 hours. And there are multiple reasons, and very few people are aware of these studies. And I'm always surprised, because if you go past 11, 12 hours, then you start seeing a major increase in gallstone formation and gallbladder operation. And that's one. And then the other one, if you look at epidemiological studies, and we have similar data now, we haven't published yet, almost every study is showing that people that skip breakfast have higher cardiovascular mortality, higher overall mortality. Now, you know, people argue, oh, yes, but that's because people that skip breakfast, this and that. I mean, fine, you know, one day maybe we'll be able to separate it. But I would say if you have a negative result over and over and over on skipping breakfast, I would say, and then you have negative results on gallstones and gallbladder operation, probably not a good idea to go past 12 or 13 hours. 12 or 13 hours is perfectly fine. It's a good way to time restrict. It's backed up by all the pillars. So if you look at centenarians, very common for them to do 12 hours of time, you know, so eating between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Very common. Very uncommon to see them doing 16 hours. Very uncommon. So I would say because of safety and also because of these negative results, stick with the 12 hours. Of course, you don't want to eat more than that because Sachin Panda and others have very clearly shown that you have problems if you eat 14, 15 hours a day.
Right.
So probably not a good idea to eat 15 hours a day and not a good idea to fast 15 hours a day. Keep it 12 and 12. And I think that that's very safe and seems to be very effective.
So, but your preferred approach and the approach that we're going to take up in part two and specifically is to do a form of intermittent fasting, but it's not really a fast. It's not like a water fast or a juice fast. It's actually a fast using certain products that actually help to, well, in fact, make people more compliant because this is, it's kind of demanding to tell people to take 5 days every month and fast, you know, unless they're, you know, a monk in a cloister or something like that. And that's actually what achieves this reboot periodically of the immune system, of the repair mechanisms, etc.
Yes. Yeah, so at first, I think I like to stay away from calling it intermittent fasting because it's not, right? It's not. It's what we call periodic fasting. And the reason for that is it doesn't really need to be once a month unless the doctor tells you it needs to be once a month. So I always say, until we have millions and millions of people that have done it, now we have maybe 25,000 people that have done it, and it looks very good. You know, the clinical trial looks good, the data from the 25,000 people or reports from doctor look good, but I think it should be done when you need to do it.
Right, so for specific conditions.
And also, you know, maybe for general maintenance, but general maintenance, it may be like twice a year. So if you're a 35-year-old athlete that has a pescatarian diet, it's very healthy. None of the risk factors are you have none of the risk factors for diseases, maybe you do it twice a year. It's probably a good idea to do it a couple of times a year. If you're somebody who's obese, who has high cholesterol, high blood pressure, high triglyceride, etc., then yes, then you may have to do it once a month under the recommendation of the doctor, and it can be used to address these problems, right? So you need to do it, and you do it once a month. Now, if you move from that to, let's say, overweight, and only one marker now is above the limit, then maybe you go and do it once every 3 months, right? So we foresee, and which is already happening, the doctors basically using it as a tool to address problems. And other than that, they can say, yeah, maybe not a good idea to do it once or twice a year, even for people that are very healthy, just because that rebooting is probably helpful at least once a year to you know any adult between the ages of 20 and 70.
Great. Okay. Good point at which to pause. We've laid the groundwork for our discussion of the FMD, the fasting mimicking diet, with our guest, the author of The Longevity Diet, Dr. Walter Longo. We'll be right back in just a moment to continue with part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast.